to provide salvation to mankind. I'm trying to put everything together, kind of show how things work, and we're going to continue that. And as we've been looking at the Old Testament, one of the big questions that really the Old Testament is asking, of course not directly, but certainly as we're looking at all the different elements, the big question is, can one escape from sin? It seems like the whole point of the Old Testament is this idea of demonstrating that man is in sin, man and God are separated because of that, and so God is working a way in which, well, man can have relief from sin. We've been looking at very, I guess, diverse elements of that. And we've been looking at primarily five key passages. And tonight we're going to be looking at the fifth one in the Old Testament. And I hope you're not sick of this slide yet, but at least one more time, we're going to look at the five key passages and finally fill in that last blank. We've been looking at Genesis chapter 3, which is really the first Old Testament key passage. That's the place where man sins. He is separated from God, contrary to God's original design and His plan. But certainly God didn't want to leave man in sin. That's not in God's nature. And so He makes this promise in Genesis chapter 12 to Abraham, where He promises that through Abraham all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. And I'm going to underscore that word tonight, that idea of blessing, because we're going to be kind of focusing a little bit on that word. But it's God blessing through the forgiveness of sin. Then we come to Exodus chapter 24, where God provides a covenant with not the whole world, but just really one nation, Israel. And it's a limited covenant. In other words, it doesn't completely satisfy all the things that God ultimately would like to do for mankind. And we're going to touch on this tonight as well. In other words, why God provided this particular covenant at this time in the course of history. But it does establish a pattern that God wanted and of course needed. The idea in that covenant is the idea of the tabernacle in which God is able to dwell with man, the priesthood which serves as a mediator between God and man, the sacrifices which provide a way of sin being forgiven, and then we also kind of touched a little bit on the idea of the Sabbath as a central part of that covenant, which allowed basically man to enjoy a type of rest, relief from the consequences of sin. And then we saw last Sunday, we saw another promise. It's an extension of the promise that God made to Abraham. That's the promise to David, basically promising that through his seed, now God is going to establish a throne and an everlasting kingdom. And, of course, that's going to be fulfilled in Christ. All of these things ultimately are pointing to Christ. And now that brings us to tonight's, I guess, the fifth key passage, and that is Jeremiah chapter 31. We'll get actually in our Bibles there eventually, but I want to talk a little bit about this whole idea, because in Jeremiah chapter 31, God promises Israel that He is going to establish a whole new covenant, and it's kind of startling. At least I would imagine it would be for a Jew to think that God is going to do away with the old covenant, the covenant that He gave to Moses, the covenant that kind of basically established that whole relationship, and it basically identified them as a nation that belonged to God. And God's going to remove that covenant and establish a whole new covenant. And it's different. I mean, God says in Jeremiah chapter 31, it's not going to be like that old covenant. It's not going to be like that one. It's going to be entirely different. And we'll talk about the nature of that covenant as Jeremiah explains that. But it kind of begs the question, why a new covenant? Why didn't God just go ahead and establish the covenant that He wanted to begin with? Why mess with the Mosaical covenant, where it clearly didn't solve all the problems that faith ban regarding sin. So I'll kind of open the floor up here at this point to kind of begin the discussion. Why do you think a new covenant? Or maybe ask even the other question, why begin with the old covenant first and then later on establish a new covenant? Any thoughts about that? Okay. Yeah, Hebrews chapter 8, he talks about, and that's where he quotes Jeremiah chapter 31 in that particular passage, where the Hebrew writer basically arguing the need for a new covenant, and in essence, it's not the covenant's fault, it's really the people's fault. And so what is it about the people? Why was there fault in them? In other words, what's really going on there? When the Hebrew writer says that there was fault in them, that is Israel or the people itself, what is it that they weren't able to do? Okay, and that's the idea of perfection. The idea of perfection. The covenant demanded perfection in order for it to really see the results. And we talked about this also in relation to the sacrifices. The animal sacrifices really didn't provide forgiveness of sins. The blood of goats and bulls simply can't take away man's sins. And so that didn't provide a solution. But the covenant itself, the idea of the covenant, what it accomplished, it would have worked if man could have been sinless, had kept it perfectly there. So that kind of goes back to the question, well, why did God have to mess with that at the beginning? Why, if man couldn't or wouldn't, I'll leave that question for another time, but if man couldn't or wouldn't keep the law perfectly, and something else was going to have to be provided in order to provide real forgiveness of sins, why even mess with that to begin with? Okay. Great, and that's exactly where I wanted to go with that. Let's turn in our Bibles in the New Testament to Galatians chapter 3. Because that's the passage one of the passages that helps explain a little bit about what the old law was for, the place that it accomplishes. And so part of, I guess, some of the things that Paul is dealing with in the book of Galatians is people were kind of flirting with the idea of going back to the old law, or that idea of the Judaizing teachers who were insisting that part of the old law be kept as a Christian. So he is comparing and basically saying that, no, that's not the case. But in chapter 3, in verse 19, he asks the question. He says, why then the law? That's a good question. That's basically what we're asking, isn't it? Why then the law? Why the old covenant? Well, he says here, it was added because of transgressions until the offspring or the seed should come to whom the promise had been made. So, in essence, he's saying that the law was added because sin was present. Sin is in the world. Paul makes an argument in Romans chapter 7. He talks about, you know, I really wouldn't have known sin unless it was for the law. And so, in essence, the law helps identify what sin is. I mean, you look at the law and that covenant involved in that, and you look at all the things that God prohibited or instructed to do to make that a holy nation, and there's a lot there. I mean, man may have had some idea about what sin is, and there's certainly indicators that was true before the law of Moses came. But once the law of Moses came, it really shines a light on sin and what it is and what it does And that, it's very important. So let's go back to Galatians chapter 3. So he says it was added because of transgression. So God brings the law because sin was in the world in essence. It was there until the seed should come according to the promise. That is basically saying until Christ would come is basically the point there. Now in verse 20 he says, now an intermediary implies more than one, but God is one. Is the law then contrary to the promises of God? In other words, and I'm trying not to make it too confusing here, but we saw in Genesis 12, God makes a promise to bless all the nations of the earth, right? And then along comes Exodus 24, the covenant. Well, is the covenant, that Mosaical law, is that an answer to the blessing? In other words, does that bless all the nations of the earth? No. So that's not the answer to the promise. I mean, it's part of the promise, I guess, in essence, but it's really not the answer. So he asked the question, is it contrary to the promise? In other words, is it doing the exact opposite? And he says, certainly not. For if a law had been given that could give life, then righteousness would indeed be by the law. But the Scripture imprisoned everything under sin, so that the promise by faith in Jesus Christ might be given to those who believe. So there's righteousness in the law, and it certainly, I guess, points to the idea of what holiness is all about. Then in verse 23, he says, now before faith came, we were held captive under the law, imprisoned until the coming of faith would be revealed. So, in essence, that picture that Paul's painting, it's not necessarily a positive light about the law, the idea of being imprisoned by it, held captive by it, but until what? In other words, what is it really, what was God really waiting for during that time that the covenant existed, the old covenant existed? Faith. And that is really the idea. And we'll look at that here in just a moment. The system of faith is what God was waiting for. So verse 24 says, so then the law was our guardian until Christ came. Now, translations are going to differ. I'm using the English Standard Version. It says guardian. I believe New King James uses tutor. Schoolmaster, that idea. And let me finish reading the context, and we'll talk about that here in just a moment. But verse 24, so then the law was our guardian until Christ came in order that we might be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a guardian, for in Christ Jesus you are all sons of God through faith, for as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. And then he says, there's neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither slave nor free, there's neither male nor female. You are all one in Christ Jesus, and if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. It's interesting. I mean, the differences in that word, in that one word, it's a little bit difficult word to translate. That's why translations vary somewhat. But they're similar in the idea. In other words, English Standard Version says a guardian, schoolmaster, tutor, those are all words. And technically, the word there is the idea of a servant who's given a charge to a pupil to take them to school, if you will. Technically speaking, that when it talks about a tutor, it's not the one who does the instruction, but it's the one who delivers the child to the place of instruction is the idea. And I think that's why the English Standard Version says a guardian. In other words, he's there protecting to make sure that child gets from the house to the school without anything happening. And that's really the idea behind this idea. The law was our guardian. And the our here, I think he's talking about the Jews. Not Christians, but the Jews. It was the Jewish tutor or the Jewish guardian until Christ should come. So basically the point is, it was a temporary means in which God could, I guess, work his plan out to being Christ into the world. It provided a temporary solution. So everything about it, in essence, God always intended to be temporary, but also in preparation to the coming of Christ. So when we think about the covenant, and we look at the Old Testament versus the New Testament, in other words, if we think about the difference between the two, in other words, I keep saying in other words, but when we look at that, when we look at the fact that, Paul just got through saying that, well, you know, righteousness came through the law. I mean, it was a good covenant. So why didn't that satisfy what God wanted to accomplish? Well, there's two things. The Old Testament, the idea about the Old Testament was justice. In other words, sin is present. Sin has to be dealt with. Sin has to be, well, punished and make sure that those consequences were met on the right person. The New Testament, the emphasis is clearly the idea of mercy. God providing a sense of kindness to those who wish to come to Him. The Old Testament emphasizes law. The New Testament emphasizes faith. Now, there's faith in the Old Testament, and there's law in the New Testament. I'm not suggesting that they're exclusive of one another, but clearly the emphasis of the Old Testament is the idea of law and perfect law-keeping. In other words, if you're going to be saved under the old system, you have to obey the law perfectly. Well, under the New Testament, you have to obey the law perfectly for salvation. Should we obey it? Yes. But I mean, is salvation based upon the perfect keeping of the law? No. It's based upon our faith in Christ. Faith is what saves us. Now, is there keeping of law? Absolutely. And I'm not suggesting otherwise here. But we're just basically talking about the idea of salvation. The old law emphasizes the idea of the curse. The old covenant is described in that particular way. It was a curse for man. Why? Well, it didn't provide forgiveness. But under the New Testament, it is blessing that God would bless. And that brings us to the last little point here, is that the Old Testament has the promise of salvation, the promise of that blessing. But the New Testament ultimately is the fulfillment of those things. And so the Old Testament has its place, and it was to prepare man for the coming of Christ. And it emphasizes very important things, but the New Testament includes better things. So that brings me to, well, another passage before we actually get into Jeremiah 31, and that is Matthew chapter 26. And of course, this is the chapter that includes Jesus observing the Passover with his disciples, and then him taking the Passover and giving those emblems, at least two of the emblems, a new meaning. And what's important here is its relationship to the covenant. So, beginning in verse 26, he says, "Now as they were eating, Jesus took bread after blessing it, broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body.' And he took the cup. And when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, 'Drink of it, all of you, for what?'" Exactly right. He says, "For this is my blood of the New Testament," or the New Covenant, depending on your translation, what he's talking about there. So, I mean, Jesus is basically saying, and you can imagine the disciples, I can only imagine, because it doesn't exactly say what the reaction is, but when he says, "This is the blood of the New Covenant," what do you think? We even went through their minds. I mean, because really, prior to this, you think about prior to Matthew chapter 26, had Jesus really even emphasized a new covenant? Had he hinted at it? Sure, absolutely. I mean, you could see things that clearly Jesus was instituting something new. And when we get to his life, we'll talk about the kingdom of heaven. And we'll talk about those things that are associated with that. And clearly, something that the disciples expected something great. But that, when Jesus, to me it's a bombshell. When he says, this is the blood of the new covenant, that is tremendous. And not only that, the next thing that he says, after he says, this is the blood of the new covenant, or the blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for what? For many to do what? Yeah, the remission of sins, the forgiveness of sins. And so that really pairs those two things together. The idea of the new covenant and what is it going to accomplish? The forgiveness of sins. You know, Jesus talked about salvation and saving Israel. You know, that he came to seek and save the lost. It seems like to me that the disciples, it's pretty clear that the disciples as well as the nation were expecting a physical redemption. In other words, they were thinking that Jesus was going to raise an army and kick the Romans out of Israel. And that's when he talked about salvation. Very often, that's probably what they were thinking about. But Jesus makes it pretty clear here. In other places too, I'm not saying this is the only place, but here, that what he came to accomplish was to forgive sins, and that was the ultimate goal of what the covenant is all about. So, let's now turn, any comments, questions before we actually go to Jeremiah 31? Yeah, yeah, when you put it all in context, when you know what's going on here, the first bombshell is the fact that this is a new covenant. You know, well, what's going to happen to the old covenant? Well, it's going to be completely replaced. And well, what's it about? It's about the forgiveness of sins. And that's where we come in on Jeremiah 31. So let's turn to Jeremiah 31. And this passage is kind of easy to remember because you think of Jeremiah 31, 31. Jeremiah 31, 31. This is the only time that the words New Covenant appear in the Old Covenant, in the Old Testament. And so we list it as one of the key passages because it really does lay out a dramatic change in how God is going to deal with Israel and really all of mankind. Jeremiah prophesied shortly before Judah was taken into captivity by Babylon. Before Babylon comes in, destroys Jerusalem, destroys the temple. Jeremiah, a large part of Jeremiah basically is telling the people of their sins and saying, you know, this is going to happen. And this punishment that God is going to inflict on you. But there's a lot of bright spots in the book of Jeremiah, and this is one of those things where Jeremiah prophesies about this coming of the new covenant. So I'm going to read verses 31 through 34, and then we're going to emphasize certain things and try to make a contrast between what Jeremiah says about the new covenant and compare it to the old covenant. So verse 31. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them. I will write on their hearts. I will be their God. They shall be my people. And no longer shall each one teach his neighbor and each brother, saying, Know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more. And so the first striking thing is this idea of a new covenant. It's there's two different ways to use the word new. There's the idea of like I got, I guess before our trip, I got a new pair of socks. Actually, I got several new pairs of socks. But they look an awful lot like my old pair of socks. They're just newer. It's basically the same, but they didn't have all the holes in the toes that my other socks had. So they, in that sense, they were new. Basically, same kind, just an updated version. The other way that we use the word new is basically where we get something completely different. Like you might have a truck, and then you decide to get a new vehicle, but instead of getting a truck, you get a car. Well, it may be new in time, but it's also new in the sense of kind, new in the experience that you have with it, just completely new in all different ways. And really the idea of the new here is new of kind, not newness of how recent it is. It's just emphasizing that this is completely, completely different. In fact, he emphasizes that idea. He says, you know, this is not going to be like a covenant. Verse 32, not like the covenant that I made with your fathers on the day when I took them by the hand. So, new in that sense. Now, beginning about verse 33, what I want to look at some of the bullet points that he talks about. What's one of the first things that he says about this covenant? In other words, he kind of lists things of why it's going to be new. What's the first description of this covenant? Okay, yep, it's going to be different. It's going to be new, all right? How's it going to be new? In about verse 33, or so about the middle of verse 33 is where we're going to pick up on there. I think where he really kind of lists those items. What does he say? All right, that's one of the first things that he talks about, this idea that the law is going to be on their hearts. Now, I think we kind of have to balance things a little bit. Did the old law involve the heart? Okay, certainly wanted it to. Yeah, I think that's right. And I think sometimes we mischaracterize the old law. And I think God did want the heart involved. I mean, you know, the two greatest commandments, according to Jesus and the law, is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, etc. And that, God said that. In other words, He wanted that heart there, that devotion, that commitment. But it certainly does seem to be lacking quite a bit. Now, I don't know if this is the intended contrast, but you know, the Ten Commandments were sort of the representative statutes for the entire law. And what were they written on? In tablets of stone. Now, again, I don't know if this is the intended contrast or not, you know, that the law was written on stone, and this particular law, and you think about it literally, I don't think he means it literally, obvious, but he says, I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts. It's not written on stone, it's actually written on the heart itself. Now, here's the interesting thing I think about this particular passage. Where were the Ten Commandments kept? It was kept within something. What was it? Where was it kept? Ark of the Covenant. And where was that kept? In the tabernacle, in the most holy place. And so the law representative, I guess, was kind of removed and separated from man. I mean, it was there, and Israel knew it was there, and it was to identify sort of that presence. But that law, in essence, symbolically, was encased encased in that ark, in the tabernacle. Now, in the New Testament, absolutely, had to be mediators of that. And that's sort of the idea here, that the sort of that what had to go, what man had to go through in order to have access to God, have access to His law. Here, the new covenant, it's going to be written where? Or He's going to put them in what? I'm going to put my law within them. In other words, I think it's the idea. God put the law in the covenant, in the old law. In the new covenant, He put it within man. Well, is there a tabernacle in the New Testament? What is it? Exactly right. All of us, each one of us, are a tabernacle. And God puts the law within us, or writes it on our heart. And we'll talk about maybe more of that here in just a second, some practical application. But what's the next thing? There's something additional, several things actually, but the next thing, what does He say? Exactly right. He says, "I will be their God, and they shall be my people." Well, wait a second. Didn't the old covenant say that? Absolutely. More than once. God says, "I will be their God. They shall be my people." So what's the difference here? Or is there a difference? I heard it, but I didn't. Okay. I'm more of a personal relationship. And I think that's the idea. With each stage that we've been looking at, you know, there's been, I guess, a closer revealing more of a closeness with God, and certainly with Christ, we're able to accomplish that. It is more so, it is emphasized in a way here in the new covenant that man did not experience in the old covenant, or even prior to that. But that is the idea. I will be their God. All right, what else? What's the next thing? Okay. Okay. That's a great point. Israel, the northern half, the kingdom, they've been gone for some time. And all that's left is basically Judah, but He's demonstrating that in the days of the unification of Israel, and that's certainly, I think, an allusion to the church, which basically is the spiritual representation of Israel at the time. That's a great point. All right, so another thing that we can add on here, after in verse 33 He says, "I will be their God, they shall be my people," what's the next difference, or the next itemized thing? Okay. Absolutely, yeah. Doug is saying here that idea that they shall all know the Lord. Verse 34 says, "No longer shall each one teach his neighbor, and each his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' for they all shall know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord." So, under the old law, did you have to know the Lord in order to be part of the covenant of the Lord? How did one enter into the covenant? Under the old law, how did one enter into the covenant? I say that again, Brother Stevens? Okay. Yeah. All right. That's exactly right. That, to be under the covenant of the old law, all you had to do was be born. And then 8 days later, if you're a male child, you were circumcised. And technically, you were under the covenant. Now, does a baby know anything really about the Lord, or much about anything? Well, no. So how did one come to know the Lord? Well, They had to be taught. They had to have instruction to know the Lord. And God provided ways to do that. And their parents would teach their children. The priests would teach the people, etc. in dealing with that. Well, hold on a second. Under the new covenant, isn't there still teaching? Don't you still have to be taught? So what's the point here? Okay. And I think that that's really the point. In the covenant of Christ, the new covenant, we enter in not because we don't know anything about God, but because we want to know Him. And once we're in, we do know Him, and truly. And of course, we have to be taught prior to becoming a Christian. But it's simply that idea that those who are part of this covenant, they know God. They know the Lord. They have that close relationship with Him in a way that is certainly different than the old law, and in many ways much better that we have here. Now, the last thing, and we're kind of getting close to time here. So the last thing, what does He say? And this is the biggie, I think. Exactly right. Their sins will be forgiven. Again, well, wait a second. I thought in the old law, God provided a way for their sins to be given. When we looked at sacrifices, I mean, didn't God say, if you perform this sacrifice, I will forgive your sin? Well, yes, He says that. So, again, what's the difference here? And I think that's exactly right. This is real forgiveness. Now, the forgiveness that Israel received through those sacrifices, they were, it was forgiveness in prospect, so to speak. I believe that they were actually forgiven, but it was only because that Christ would come and His sacrifice would be able to provide real forgiveness. And This, again, the question is, can man escape from sin? That was how we kind of began this particular class tonight. Can man escape his sin? And Jeremiah answers that question. Yes, there is coming a covenant in which it's going to be completely different, and that sin will truly, truly be forgiven. Now, just got about a couple minutes here. Brent had already referenced Hebrews chapter 8. Let's turn to the book of Hebrews. Because the Hebrew writer quotes extensively Jeremiah 31 in a couple different places. He quotes in chapter 8, and he quotes in chapter 10 also. And I'm not going to... I would love to. I would love for us to kind of dig into Hebrews and talk about the different things here. But in chapter 8 is that comparison between the two covenants. In verse 7 of chapter 8, you know, that question in our mind, well, why establish that covenant, the old covenant, to begin with? Was there something wrong with the covenant? Well, verse 7 he says, for if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. In other words, so... If the old covenant was able to do what God really wanted it to do, then He would never have looked for something else. Verse 8, He says, for He finds fault with them when He says, and that's when He quotes Jeremiah chapter 31. And really, Hebrew writers not placing blame on God's own covenant, but really placing blame on the people's inability to keep that law. And so he quotes that passage that we just read in Jeremiah chapter 31. In verse 13, he says, in speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one, and what's that word? He makes the first one obsolete. and what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. Just a side note. I mean, for those that want to, appeal to authority, things done in the Old Testament, this doesn't make any sense to do it. It's obsolete. There's something much greater in the covenant of Christ, and that's what we should look for all of our authority, because that's really the only authority that is in existence at this time. All right, well, Bill's going to ring any second now. Any last thoughts or comments? Yes, Doug? Sacrifice was perfect. Just real quick, because I know the bell's going to ring, but chapter 10, verse 1, he says, "For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come." So the best that you can say about the old covenant, there are a lot of good things about it, but it was a shadow of the reality of Christ, the reality of that covenant. What we live under now is really what God wanted to accomplish. And he promised Abraham to bless all the nations of the earth. And the old law, it was important. It helped identify sin for us. It helped basically prepare the way for the coming of Christ. It emphasized, the need for forgiveness, the need for faith, the need for all the sins that we had talked about in that particular list. But it's truly, truly important. All right, somebody's late on the bell. It's not me. I'm pretty sure. That's not her. I apologize. I've been getting going. I kept going until no time. Anyway, for Sunday, we're going to be looking at the captivity and the remnant. Captivity of Babylon and the remnant. We'll stop there.